The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Imagine, so unless you people start get their lunch, I'm going to go ahead and start with an introduction to our speaker today. By the way, I know most of you, but there's some new faces in the room. My name is Susanna Stock-Wolfe, and I run the War Crimes Research Office here at the school. I teach in related areas of international criminal law, international humanitarian law. And we run a World Cup speaker series during the academic year where we bring practitioners from the tribunals, from experts in the areas of international criminal law and international humanitarian law to speak to you about their work, about the challenges in their work, about how their work fits into larger justice goals or developing goals, which will be the focus of Kristen's remarks today. We'll also have an opportunity for questions, and so if you want to ask her about how she, as a practitioner, goes into this field and she thinks about practicing this field, this is also a good opportunity to do that. So a little bit about her background. She's been the senior program officer at the International Criminal Court's Trust Fund for Victims. Victims, as you will hear in a moment, have a very unique role at the International Criminal Court. And there's this unique fund, this unique organ, part of the court, that is called the Trust Fund for Victims. And Kristen will tell you a little bit about what that is. She's been there for the last 6 years. She's responsible for managing the administration, program operations, and field support for administering victims' assistance and reparation in situations under the jurisdiction of the court. And so mostly in Africa, and most of the programming is in Africa. It's called a public health anthropologist with a standout record leading development, public health, gender equity, and human rights efforts in over 25 countries around the world, primarily in Africa, but for different agencies, for USAID, World Bank, UNICEF, WHO, CARE International, OSI, among others, and now at the ICC. So if you don't mind the distraction as we're kind of settling in, I want to welcome you to our speaker series.
Thank you, Susanna. Thank you so much to the War Crimes Research Office. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the invitation. It's always nice to be with students and other people, be able to talk about the work at the Trust Fund and the ICC. Bon appetit, everyone. Can I ask, just with a show of hands, how many people are aware of the Trust Fund? Okay, a few people. Oh, good. How many people here have worked around the ICC or at the ICC? Okay, good, a few people. And I see that some people aren't aware, so why don't I just give you sort of the overview as to the uniqueness of the Trust Fund and how it relates to the court. The Trust Fund is a manifestation of actually the Rome Statute. The Rome Statute created two institutions, the ICC and the Trust Fund, and oftentimes people aren't aware that it's actually two institutions that were created out of the Rome Statute. From our understanding, you know, and then those of you who may have been around for the drafting of the Rome Statute, a lot of the human rights activists and civil society really mobilized around the drafting and the provisions related to victims. I think lots of lessons learned from other tribunals, the courts and so on. And I think the lessons learned from that process, the judiciary processes, was that victims waited a very long time to receive justice, if at all. And this was always a concern. And oftentimes during a very long judiciary process, victims didn't receive any support of any kind in terms of assistance, not only on an individual level, but also within their communities. And then once there were convictions in other tribunals, there weren't options, and there haven't been options to administer reparations linked to criminal justice proceedings in the special tribunals. And so because of that, you'll see the uniqueness of some of the provisions in the Rome Statute. Victims are integrated in a way that is unique. There is victims' participation, which is coming from the civil law, and that has been merged with common law. But victims' participation is a unique piece of the ICC, and we can talk a little bit about that. But the other unique piece is that there is a trust fund set alongside the ICC that has a dual mandate. And the dual mandate is we can provide assistance in communities once an ICC jurisdiction is opened. And so we have to wait, obviously, for a determination in the pretrial chamber, which makes determinations related to the situation. And once the situation is formally opened, it means the trust fund can make a determination to carry out an assessment in the situation to identify the types of victims, types of harm, location of crime, and the type of assistance that needs to deliver to the assistance mandate. Now, people often ask us with that mandate, what is your definition of victims? And the definition for victims for us on the assistance mandate is broader than the narrow definition of victims on a case. And so we are able to apply the definition of victims under our rules and regulations, which also involves families, which means we can provide direct support to victims under the jurisdiction and support also to their families and communities. So we have indirect recipients as well. Our assistance mandate is actually legally defined in terms of the type of assistance we can provide. It's physical rehabilitation, psychological rehabilitation, and material support. And within that, we have a lot of room to program the support in a meaningful way. And I'll talk a little bit about that further. So this is obviously one mandate. The other mandate, which has not been initiated yet, although there have been legal filings around it, is the reparations mandate. And certainly we have a first conviction at the court on the Lubanga case, which is in appeals right now, so it's difficult for me to talk too much about that. However, I can say, and these are public filings, if you're interested to look at the filings on the ICC website, I would encourage you to do so. Some very interesting legal discussions around how to define reparations on that case, which is under consideration right now in the appeals chamber. There was a decision in the trial chamber, and again, I think some of the parties submitted observations related to those decisions. Primarily, the points under contention are who's responsible for assessing harm related to the reparations order and the victim identification. The trial chamber did delegate all of that to the trust fund, and I think victims' counsel as well as the trust has different opinions about what our role is vis-a-vis especially those two areas. And of course, the other aspect of the filing was whether they would be individual reparations or collective reparations. And of course, Lubanga is indigent, and it's difficult to envision individual claims based on his indigent status. However, the trust fund is advocating for accountability and responsibility that obviously once we get through the appeals process and if the conviction holds, then even there should be a symbolic way for him to fulfill the court order for reparations. And I think that that's really important for victims and really important for these communities. The trust fund is able to use our voluntary contributions to complement a court order for reparations. So this is the uniqueness of this structure. Now, we are in a process of legally defining what does it mean to complement. So this is also part of the debate. We have one position on that, others have another position, and the judges will make a determination. But for us, if we're applying the rules of the trust fund that govern the use of our voluntary contributions, for us, reparations then would favor a collective approach. And I think within the context of not only this case in terms of Lubanga, but in general, the situations under the court, and more specifically Eastern Congo, where you have ongoing conflict, you have a prosecutorial strategy that was narrowly defined, and in this case, on the Lubanga case, one ethnic group, one rebel leader, and the victims on that case were only within that ethnic group and former child soldiers under that rebel leader. And of course, they were allegedly perpetrators as well. So the definition of victims didn't include their victims. We would argue for a broader approach toward reparations that was more collective, community-based, that doesn't do additional harm within these communities. That certainly targets the victims that are specifically defined on the case, but again, goes broader into these communities in terms of linking to reconciliation efforts and symbolic approaches as well. So again, you might be really interested to see some of the filings if you haven't already. There were other groups that filed amicus briefs on the case as well. UNICEF and another group, Women's Initiatives for Gender Justice, and I think ICTJ as well filed on that case. So it's an interesting read. So we've been really operational on the assistance mandate since 2008. In order for us to proceed, and this is the link to the court related to the assistance, once we carry out the assessment, our board of directors makes a determination on the recommendations submitted by the secretariat. And then we submit a filing to the pretrial chamber. So this is a very unique link to the court in terms of providing victims assistance. It's a public filing. Again, you can see these filings. We submit in the pretrial chamber, and again, it allows for observations from all parties, specifically prosecution, defense, and victims counsel, to ensure that our activities are not going to prejudice in any way the judiciary process. And here lies always a lot of questions related to, are we providing assistance to victims and witnesses on the cases? And we say, no, not that we are aware of. Victims and witnesses on the cases of the ICC receive support in other areas of the court through the Victims Witness Unit, as well as some support through the OTP and intermediaries that work around the court. We support victims more broadly, as I said, in the situation, and we're currently supporting about 110,000 victim beneficiaries, both in Eastern Congo and Northern Uganda. And so, again, we have no way of knowing whether any of those beneficiaries are also linked to a case, and we would prefer not to know. We try to stay neutral to the judiciary process. No information that we gather through the assistance mandate is provided to the court, and also investigators are not allowed to show up at our services and also obtain any evidence or information related to our mandate appeal. It also means that we are often in locations before the investigators of the ICC. We were in the Kivus 2 years before the prosecutor's office sent investigators there. So it just tells you we're on the ground oftentimes before there are investigations. And we don't necessarily administer our support linked to where the investigations are ongoing. So we can go much broader, as I said. In the context of Northern Uganda, of course, the situation for Uganda is Northern Uganda. It's not other areas of Uganda. We, in many respects, have been almost the only face of the court operating in the context of Uganda. And of course, Uganda's situation is very different than Eastern Congo in terms of its recovery process. It's 6-7 years post-conflict. Most of the refugees and IDPs have returned from the camps. But of course, what we see, what has gone on, is they're in a recovery, post-conflict reconstructive effort. And this is, again, the link with development. When we carried out the assessment, we found that most humanitarian organizations had pulled out of the north. The government was talking about what was called the PRDP process, which is the World Bank program for the reconstructive process in northern Uganda. The government said that they, as part of that process, was going to provide support to the victims of the conflict there. But when we actually went out on the ground, talked to victims, talked to these affected communities, to grassroots organizations, traditional and religious leaders, we found very little going on. And where we saw the gaps were the victims of the LRA who had been mutilated. And here, there was an engendered response to the conflict in the north. I don't know if you're aware, but the LRA really targeted women and girls as part of the mutilation. And there were reasons for this in terms of really impacting the communities and also impacting the ability for women and girls to either continue within their families or to be marriageable and so on. And so we focused our support there in terms of plastic surgery, reconstruction, other types of surgical interventions in terms of victims who were burned. We're the only organization providing the support. And we've also found that the development efforts haven't linked up to providing any support to trauma, not only on an individual level, but also collective trauma. And I think these are always the challenges when you're working in the development sector. How can we rebuild? How can we work with societies to rebuild if they're traumatized? And trauma can be passed intergenerationally, and certainly when people are sort of walking images of trauma when they've been so terribly mutilated, this is also even more difficult. And so we are working with the Center for Victims of Torture to help build local capacity to provide trauma-based counseling for the victim beneficiaries in northern Uganda linked to the surgical interventions. And from that, we learned that in order for victims to really help rehabilitate and recover so that they can become active members of society, we were addressing the stigma, discrimination, and the trauma. However, there was a livelihood component that was missing. And also reconciliation that needs to happen oftentimes across the ethnic divide. And so what we did is we worked with CARE International, who had a very big program in the north. They had a village savings and loan program that wasn't necessarily targeted to the victims of the LRA and other victims within the north. And so we worked with them to leverage that program to integrate village savings and loans and victims association livelihood cooperatives. And we brought victims, men and women, together across ethnic groups, across communities that had experienced conflict. We incorporated the trauma-based counseling in a collective way and also access to the medical services. And we have found great success in this over a five-year period. In fact, to the point where the victims themselves, the cooperatives, are self-sustaining. They don't even require other donor support after 5 years. So again, I think it's looking at development from a different approach in terms of how you target this kind of type of victimized community and beneficiary, and working with existing development partners to leverage their ongoing programs and just helping them link it up in a different way. In the context of Congo, of course, the nature of the conflict is different, and it's ongoing. And the conflict in Kivus is different than in Ituri. The underlying causes are different. And where you have ongoing conflict, it makes it very difficult to work to help build infrastructure and local capacity. So what we've had to do is think creatively with our grassroots partners to look for ways of incorporating reconciliation as part of our rehabilitation mandate. And the reconciliation is really at three levels. One level is at the community level. We work through an organization called RHA, and we administer a caravan de la paix, a peace caravan that goes to the communities, and it has engaged tens of thousands of people in eastern Congo. And it brings together men, women, and young people to talk about the crimes that have occurred, to talk about the underlying causes. And again, this is across ethnic groups, and they have trained facilitators that help them with this. It's conflict resolution, and some would say even prevention at one level. And the communities themselves are able to stand up in public to talk about what's happened, to also come together. And, of course, we disaggregate this. Sometimes we prefer to have women do this alone, obviously, for many reasons. And sometimes we also have just groups of victims of sexual and gender-based violence also do this as a group. And they come together, develop plans in order to move forward and heal together collectively. So again, this is a very collective approach, and we have also started to integrate village savings and loans through that type of experience, and we're finding it's actually moved much faster in Congo than it did in Uganda. It's taken off after 2 years, and they're already self-sustaining in terms of the livelihood component. Our ability to incorporate trauma-based counseling is more challenging for us in Congo because of the lack of health infrastructure for us to link to. But we have been linking to medical services. We focus primarily on victims of sexual and gender-based violence. Lots of referrals to Pepsi Hospital, for example, for fistula repair and STD screening, HIV screening, and so on. Also, post-operative care and follow-up. We're also focusing support on former child soldiers. And again, this is really important. We've had to link to the recovery and the development efforts. Many of you may be aware of the DDR process that has gone on in the context of DRC, the demobilization process that's usually managed by UNICEF and the World Bank and the government itself. And through that process, if you look at the strategy, for example, there's a gender strategy as part of that. But when we went out and assessed and carried out our assessment to go and talk to former girl child soldiers to realize that actually they didn't go through the DDR process at all. Very few cases of that. Because the DDR process didn't really have rehabilitation initiatives that were focused on their vulnerabilities, that were focused on their needs. And oftentimes what happens with young women who were either conscripted or abducted or enlisted, is they come back with children. They come back with children either born out of rape or other means, and they are not only not accepted back into their communities, but oftentimes are having difficulty in terms of the mother-child bond. And they also often have missed school. So high rates of illiteracy as well. And so what we've done is we've focused our efforts, again, linking to development partners. We work with an Italian NGO, COPI, to leverage their development support, again, to look at a different way of programming it so that we're targeting these kinds of beneficiaries and looking at reconciliation at a different level, and that is between mother and child. How can we build the bond between mother and child and their families to address the stigma, discrimination, to help them with reintegration back into their families, and we provide accelerated literacy training for these young women, and also link it to the livelihood, village savings and loan cooperatives. And again, we have found that this integrated approach, which is multisectoral, linked to development, has been really important in the recovery and reintegration of these young women. We also are looking at ways of building capacity of young people themselves to be bearers of peace. I mean, again, this is the really important prevention piece of all of this. If young people are learning how to be peace bearers, peacemakers within their own families and communities, then we hope that this will also prevent additional conflict. So we have built with Caritas peace schools throughout Ituri that has a curriculum for teaching young people about conflict resolution, about how to work within their families and communities to be bearers of peace. And what's interesting, what's come from that, is the students themselves have come together and in very Congolese fashion wrote music. They wrote music themselves about their experiences around conflict, their ethnic differences, issues that have happened to them personally and also within their families, and they've recorded it on CD and have been selling it to generate more income for their schools. And this happened organically. It wasn't even something that we had inserted into the program. So I think oftentimes with this kind of approach, when you have a lot of flexibility and you don't narrowly define a program, you can allow for things to happen organically within these communities so that whatever responses are culturally appropriate and locally relevant and owned by the communities themselves. So you can see that this is a unique piece of the Rome Statute, that you have the ability to have this human face of the court and this assistance that is being provided ongoing while there are either trials ongoing or not. In the context of Uganda, we don't have trials. And so we've wanted to measure what does this mean? What does this mean for victims so that we have a baseline? And we've incorporated social science methods, which I think is a sort of new effort within the justice sector in the last several years. But we conducted a baseline with 2,600 victim beneficiaries in eastern Congo and northern Uganda to assess what was the impact of violence for them. What has been the impact of our assistance? Obviously, we need to measure that. But what is also their perception of justice? What is their perception of reconciliation and of reparations and of rehabilitation? And I think that's been a really important baseline for us to have. We plan to go back next year and the following year to conduct it again, to have longitudinal data to compare differences over time. But a couple of things happened for us when we did this approach. And one was we were surprised to find how engendered violence was. And I think perhaps it's not a surprise, but we were surprised to find that the impact of violence is different on men and boys than it is on women and girls. And the difference here really lies for victims of sexual and gender-based violence. That for them, they very rarely feel that they have received justice, that they have been part of any criminal justice measure. They haven't felt that they've benefited from development efforts in ways, for example, that their male counterparts who were former child soldiers have. And that was very telling. And also helped us with targeting that support and also feeding that information back to development actors within these communities where they were working. The other issue that we found that was very telling was that when the victims were aware of where the support was coming from, when they knew it was the trust fund, and when they knew the trust fund was part of the Rome Statute linked to the ICC, that they felt that they were being recognized and receiving a form of justice. So I think that's very unique. And of course, when they didn't know that, that was there was a big difference. And here lies our challenge. In places where you have ongoing conflict, it's difficult for our implementing partners to always label the support that's going to those victims as ICC trust fund. As you can imagine, we may have questions around that. Versus in a place like Uganda, where it's much easier for us to do so, and in Congo, that's been harder. And I think that that's really important information for us, not only on the assistance mandate, but also on reparations and how we move forward, and how it's so important for victims to be aware of not only that they've been recognized on a court order, but that they are participating in that mechanism, and that they understand that they are receiving justice linked to a conviction at the ICC. So, I mean, I think that gives you a broad overview, and I think at this point we have half an hour to engage in a discussion. I'm happy to take your questions about our work in general, and I mentioned earlier also, if you want to just talk about, you know, how do you work in this field of not only transitional justice, but also more broadly development. Obviously, I come from the health sector, and I've worked about 25 years in that sector. But so often, we really have to integrate efforts now across sectors. So I'm happy to also talk about that.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's interesting. We've incorporated the findings through different reports. So they've been incorporated. If you go to our website, all of our public program reports are on the website. We have it in English and French. And I think we've incorporated those findings in at least three different reports and also in our filing, our reparations filing. I've never had the opportunity to actually pull it all together. But it's on my list. Even though the information will be 3 years old, I think it's really important to have in the public domain.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so now it's your turn. Questions?
Sorry. I had a question about sort of the relationship that you have with, you know, let's say the registry from the ICC on the field. Do you find that, for instance, with, you know, this peace caravan approach, for instance, where you have the victims telling their stories, do you find that that kind of conflicts with the investigations that maybe the registry or the OTP is doing at the same time, perhaps? Do you ever, you know, has there ever been conflict between the two?
And to follow up with that, you said that you don't share information. Has the court ever tried to subpoena somebody that was in your assistance program? Can information be forcibly obtained?
Shall I take a few?
Others?
I think.
We'll go back in just a second. Go ahead.
So I understand that you said you don't start until the ICC opens its situation, but how long would these programs go until?
It's related but unrelated. I'll start with that. Since this is such a great program, the ICTY didn't ever have the chance to implement this. Like, in the context of the former Yugoslavia, is there a way that it can be incorporated? Because, I mean, it's been almost 20 years since the war, and things aren't getting better, almost getting worse, really. So is there a way that that could still be incorporated?
Yeah. Why don't I start there? And,
Thank you. I think it's very important and that you're measuring justice and the perceptions of justice, because I think that's one of the big problems with these development programs. And I wonder, have there been any programs that you have attempted to implement in terms of reparations that have not been successful and actually possibly caused more damage?
I'll start with the first question. So, registry and OTP separately, right? Because they obviously have different mandates. We In terms of the structure, the trust fund is independent from the court. However, we are administered by the registry. We do not have an independent legal personality from the court. So, for example, it means that our implementing partners administer the assistance under an ICC contract, which can pose challenges for them, as you can imagine. For example, when the El Bashir arrest warrant was issued, CARE International and Oxfam were our major partners, and we wanted to be very public. We just signed with them, and we couldn't because they were getting PNG from Darfur. And so, you know, one thing, having this kind of structure linked to a court, all kinds of operational realities occur that the lawyers drafting the legal frameworks couldn't have envisioned. Anyway, that's just an aside. We have field staff based in Kampala and Bunia, and they sit in the ICC field offices. We rely on a registry for all of our field support, and we are part of their planning. So obviously transport, security, administration, and so on. So we work quite closely with registry. We also, at a global level, administer our budget and finance, our procurement. Everything is through registry. With that said, there are a couple of areas where I think we could all do a lot better. And then I'm saying that, you know, in a nice sort of way. The trust fund has not been integrated or incorporated, for example, in the court's outreach and communication strategy. And I think at some level that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate at the global level for obvious reasons in terms of having a unique base of victims and communities around the court, but at the community level, it's created a lot of confusion. It's created confusion because it is confusing, even for all of us, and it took us time to understand how we operate alongside the court and what does that mean and how we relate to each other. But you can imagine for communities, it's even more confusing. We also, because we use the same vehicles oftentimes as the investigators, they can get very confusing when my staff are in a car and show up in communities. And so that was another lesson learned. We had to really work with the court to understand that the trust fund needs separate even vehicles so that we're not identified with the ongoing process around the investigators. And also not putting our partners in harm's way as well as our beneficiaries. So I think around the outreach and advocacy component, we need to work together more closely. In terms of investigators, OTP, I mean, look, we have, there haven't been a whole lot of interactions. However, a couple of times it did happen by accident or not, I don't know, where investigators showed up to our intermediaries, our partners. And, you know, it was easy. There was the trust fund logo. There was the sign. They knew we were targeting victims in a certain way. It would have been a very easy way to come and access information. And I immediately got the call and went over to the OTP, and we made sure that that didn't happen again. So I think, you know, this is the importance of having a close rapport and relationship with OTP in an informal way so that we make sure that we're protecting our service provision and our partners. Outside of that, we've not had much interaction except for informal discussions with OTP on other matters. You know. We've never been subpoenaed to provide any information. Now, we at the beginning of the trust fund, it seemed that some of our intermediaries and implementing partners were also intermediaries with the court in other ways. And this was at a time when there were concerns around intermediaries on the Katanga and Rwanda cases. This would have been around 2008, I think. So we did have to clean that up, but luckily this was at the very beginning of administering our assistance. And there were three partners in particular that we had to phase out quickly and no longer engage with. We're the only area of the court that has contractual relationships with intermediaries. The rest of the court doesn't. So in that sense, it's easy for us because, you know, we have a formal relationship. And so we always go through an informal verification process in the court. We make sure our implementing partners are not engaged with the registry for their victims application process, for their outreach program, as well as obviously with the OTP related to any work around their investigations and witnesses, and also with the BWU for witness protection. the management of safe houses, so we can't obviously engage intermediaries of supporting the court as implementing partners. And so far, I think there's been no, since 2008, overlap, and we've never been asked to provide information for their processes. How long is the program? Really interesting question. The legal framework is silent on that. Again, I think a lot of the lawyers that drafted the rules and regulations over the trust fund and our mandates didn't think about exiting. They didn't think about, so, well, we'll just deal with this, I think, on a programmatic level, and the board will have to make a determination as well. But what's not clear for, I mean, there are lots of questions around this. One is just from a Juneau harm approach. Whenever we transition or exit, we have to make sure that we're not doing additional harm, that we build a sustainability plan as part of that. And we do it in such a way that the beneficiaries are aware, that we transition in a way that is, you know, that if we have patients, they're going to other services and so on. We don't know what that will mean, for example, if jurisdiction changes. So, you know, lots of discussions around Kenya. Or if it's suspended. And what does that mean if the trust fund is operational or if we're just trying to engage and launch activities? We have a situation now in the Central African Republic, so there are operational realities too. The ICC office is close, the office in Bangui, because of the coup and the conflict there. And it was a week we were launching our assistance mandate. And we were launching our support for victims of sexual and gender-based violence. Nobody is providing support. I mean, poor CAR. They just, it's so difficult to get any support into that country. And we couldn't administer this because we have no field office. So there's also a practical reality. So there are lots of challenges around exiting. And we are finding that we are working through that now. In our next strategic planning process, we have to have some guidance on this and some thoughtfulness around this. But I think it will depend on the situation. ICTY, interesting you ask. 2 years ago, of course we all have friends there, and the presidency 2 years ago called the trust fund in to advise that they wanted to try to establish some type of reparations, I wouldn't say fund, but initiative. Of course, it was very late in the game, and they didn't necessarily have a legal framework for that. And they weren't clear whether the donors had the appetite for it, but as part of the legacy project. So we advised them on our lessons learned and things that they would have to consider both legally and practically. We gave them advice also on how to mobilize resources around it. And then we connected them to the IOM at the UN. And the IOM has just released a report on their work with the ICTY, which has been carried out over the last 2 years, then consulting also the communities in former Yugoslavia to see what kinds of forms of redress, even symbolic, that they can provide as part of the legacy of the ICTY. I haven't read the report myself. I know it came around, I think, like 6 weeks ago. So it's new. It's out. And, you know, we'll have to see what happens for them. I don't know. But it is part of their legacy project, so I would take a look at that.
I have an international organization.
Their reparations program. Measuring justice. Yeah, I mean, look, as a social scientist, it's critical that we not only measure, but we incorporate qualitative methods as part of our program. We're also building capacity of our partners to carry that out as well, so it's operations research. We're feeding back the results of the information always and developing our indicators and reporting based on that. We aren't implementing reparations yet. Yeah, because you asked about reparations.
It's activities that have,
right,
like the caravan and,
right,
village saving loans.
Right. In terms of, because you asked, have we had things that weren't successful? Well, an interesting question. Well, two things. One is we're in the process right now of being externally evaluated. So I think it, for the sake of transparency, it's really important, and we will have that report. We will launch it at the Assembly of States Parties meeting in November. An institute here in Washington, D.C. has actually carried out the external evaluation, ICRW, the International Center for Research on Women. they will launch the report at the ASB. And in there, they'll give their external evaluation on our program. With that said, we have along the way had projects that were less successful than others. And I think it's the nature of doing this kind of work in the situations where we're doing. I can't assess whether we've done harm within these communities because of that. I think what's happened is actually mismanagement, mostly. Or, for example, we have a situation where we're engaged, I won't say exactly who, but with the archdiocese in Uganda. And the bishop is getting too political, really, and has led the submission of a petition against the TJ program in Uganda. So we don't feel that we should be engaged anymore with funding this archdiocese directly. So it's that type of, but we've had also partners in the context of Uganda, for example, that were unhappy because they weren't managing, and we audited them, and we had to transition them because of all kinds of concerns. And then we had lots of public outcry in the press against us, against CARE International as well. You know, and again, this is just part of managing this kind of response. I don't have information to answer you specifically about whether we've done harm or not, but I hope not. That was it. Any other
questions? Yeah, in the back.
Yeah, I have a question. This is more broad. I don't know if you have any insight or thoughts. So I know about the situation in Colombia right now, where they are, you know, negotiating peace agreement. And then I hear in the news, like I read the newspaper sometimes, or I hear the news, and then they talk about how the EIC might intervene in an eventual agreement. I don't know what they're really talking about. Do you have any? Can you give any comments as to what is it that they're specifically talking about when they say, oh, any agreements has to, you know, be under, I mean, has to be approved by the ICC, or the ICC might intervene to kind of, you know.
Are you from Colombia?
Yes.
Colombia is a situation under observation, and it has been under observation by the OTP for some time.
8 years.
8 years. And I think, you know, from what I understand and what's in the public domain, it seems that there have been efforts around complementarity in terms of having Colombia deal with this, and you can probably speak to that more than I can.
Yeah, maybe it'd be helpful to explain a little bit about complementarity. So unlike some of the other tribunals we've been talking about, like the ICTY, the Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia, which had primacy over cases, the concurrent jurisdiction that could pull a case out of a territory of the former Yugoslavia, the ICC is a court of last resort. So it only steps in if the national system isn't doing anything, isn't investigating or prosecuting. And even if it is, the court can assess whether it is really able and willing to do it, or unable or unwilling, the reverse, right? So the idea is it's been under preliminary examination for quite some time. The prosecutor's office has been accompanying the developments of the peace and justice law and the implementation of the peace and justice law to see whether or not Colombia demonstrates a willingness and capacity and ability to actually prosecute the crimes that are in the jurisdiction of the Rome Statute, the ICC, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. Perhaps applicable there. But so the idea is, all over the last 8 years, there have been different efforts by the Colombian national system, which I'm sure you accompanied, that indicate some progress in the prosecution of those crimes. In November of last year, the Office of the Prosecutor released a pretty lengthy, detailed report on how the Colombian national system was doing. And identified measures of that where they have progressed, and then areas where they were still lacking. And so this is why you see this sort of ongoing conversation between Colombia and the ICC, is that they continue. continue to monitor what's happening. To the extent that the ICC or the prosecutor decides or determines that not enough is happening and those gaps aren't being filled, then he, current prosecutor, could go to a pretrial chamber of the court and ask for approval for initiating an investigation into the situation. So that's sort of the idea behind complementarity. In the statute, what you have is negative complementarity. The court doesn't step in until. But in practice, the OTP has adopted an approach of positive complementarity to try to encourage states to develop their capacity and willingness to pursue cases within the jurisdiction.
That makes sense. Interestingly enough, the former commissioner of the reparations mechanism, Eduardo Pizarro, was on our board for the trust fund, and he was on our board for 3 years. So we also benefited from obviously his experience and expertise. We learned a lot from the Colombian experience administering reparations, and in fact, I was there in 2010. I was in Bogota, and I also went to Medellin to see how it was operationalized and to also certainly meet with government and others, but then without government, I met with victims themselves and civil society. And it was interesting to obviously hear the points of view from different perspectives about how they received the reparations, which were, you know, which are administered and funded by the state. So that's an administrative regime. And I think, you know, very different than reparations linked to a criminal proceeding. But lots of lessons learned from that experience. And then I think one thing we heard is that victims really wanted to feel that there was accountability linked to that. And I think there were lots of concerns around that in the Colombian context.
One of the areas identified where Colombia is not making much progress is the prosecution of gendered sexual violence crimes committed in the context of conflict. So
that's an issue.
All right, other questions? Any questions about the idea of practicing in this field? Or
are you all wanting to be sort of litigators, or what's the plan?
Policy.
Thank you. In the intersection in development and law, and since you've had to deal with both of them, I suppose, while working with the ICC and also through providing reparations, what do you think is the best route to balance both of them at the same time in a career? Or how do you think each one of them complements each other?
A good question. I think, I'll just say that in terms of how you gain experience, I think it's really important to get field experience. And I think when you're in the field, or if you come from the Global South, obviously you understand it in a different way than those of us that come from the Global North. But to be in the field, you'll see for communities, they don't differentiate their lives by sector. Right. You know, people live their lives in a way that they need either assistance or basic needs from a variety of approaches. And obviously, access to justice and human rights are part of that, depending on the context. So I would say always get a grassroots perspective to your work, and it will help to answer that question for you. For you to figure out what does that mean in terms of how you manage your career and the kinds of organizations you want to work for. I also say, you know, then work from a variety of perspectives. You know, if you can work at a headquarters somewhere, that's also important. Work in different kinds of agencies. If you can work in civil society as well, I think certainly that's a different perspective than working for a court or working for an international organization. I think the justice sector is actually quite late in coming to figure out links of how to link to development and how to apply lessons learned. I almost feel like sometimes the justice sector is trying to recreate what we've known, the 30 years in other sectors. And so, you know, I think, I would say in the last 2 years, that's shifting a little bit. Certainly when I started 6 years ago, it was like, really? Qualitative research? You know, you want to create a whole new methodology? You know, we've been doing this outreach. What do you mean you don't know how to measure impact or behavior change? You know, we've been doing this in health for 30 years. So it's we haven't had enough fora bringing together practitioners. And I see in the transitional justice sector, they'll say they're convening a meeting with development, but I came from a meeting last week in New York. Prime example, UNDP, ICTJ, not to target them, but however, it was actually the Center for Transitional Justice, was convening a meeting on linking transitional justice to development. And who was in the room? They were all TJ people. Well, of course, UNDP was present, and they considered that development, but it was the TJ unit within the UNDP. So, sorry to say, it was the same people talking to each other, yet representing a development agency. What you need is to convene a meeting where you're engaging practitioners from other sectors to talk about not only lessons learned, but how to mobilize support, how to make that meaningful for the constituencies that you're supporting or working for and representing. And I think that hasn't happened so much, and I think there's lots of opportunities to not only do that at a global level, but do that at the community or regional levels as well, and have that regional expertise also participate in the conversation. So that this is really kind of the beginning of all of this. So I think it's very exciting for those of you that want to work multi-sectoral, coming from the justice sector. Lots of opportunities for PhD research too. I think it's a whole area that's emerging. Yeah. Sorry,
you have one other hand here. You?
No, it's okay.
You sure?
Yeah.
You sure?
It was pretty much the same. Like, how do we incorporate our law degree with, like, on the ground field work with victims?
Yeah. I mean, you know, civil society, I would really try to, you know, engage with civil society, and lots of NGOs are doing that kind of work and that kind of experience. You know, the ICC itself also, because of the victims' participation piece, that's also very unique to the courts, and they also engage both interns as well as field staff around that. I would encourage all of you, if you're interested, there is an internship program at the court. It is open for you to apply. Even people always say, can Americans apply? Yes, you can. But the internship program is not funded, so you have to find your own funding for participating. But we do have a lot of Americans and others as interns at the court. You can also specify which area of the court you're interested in.
Can they intern with the fund?
Yep, we encourage people to select the trust fund if they're interested.
And there are maybe two other victim kind of specific units at the court: the Victim Participation and Reparations Section, which is under the Registry, and the OPCV, the Office of Public Counsel for Victims. And that is sort of you know, has a couple of controversial roles, but one of them is to serve as an institutional repository of knowledge for representatives that are for legal representatives that are representing participants in the trial proceedings. And so those are the two offices that you could identify along with the trust fund for victims.
Unfortunately, you can't go to the field as part of the internship program at the ICC, but anyway, it does offer. For the sake of transparency, my partner runs the Women's Initiatives for Gender Justice, but they also have an internship program based in The Hague, and they also do some really interesting work around gender justice issues. So, you know, you can also take a look at that as well.
Oh, I'm going to the
last one.
Sorry. What's the minimum time we can do an internship?
6 months.
6 months.
No, that's the maximum.
Okay. I think 3 months.
Yeah, 3 months.
3 months.
Yeah.
Well, join me in thanking Kristen for having a happy weekend despite the rain.